Hello, welcome back to another episode of Embracing Data. I'm Marian Vidal Fernandez, and today I have the pleasure to be chatting with Sasha Becker. Sasha is a professor of economics, both at the University of Warwick and Monash University. His research focuses on economic history and the economics of religion, a fascinating intersection of topics. Sasha, welcome to Embracing Data, and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to our chat.
Sasha has worked on a range of very interesting topics. He has studied the short and long run effects of historical events on socioeconomic outcomes. For example, why suicide rates are more common among Protestants than Catholics? Which type of networks facilitated Jewish academics' emigration from Nazi Germany? Or how the Second World War improved the marriage prospects of surviving Italian men? I think each of these topics deserves its own podcast, Sasha. Keep that thought. Now, what makes you interested in using data to measure the impact of religion or historical events on socioeconomic outcomes?
Well, I think I've always been interested in history for its own sake. I've read books and find historic episodes fascinating, but also I find religion fascinating and interesting. And even though we may today think that we live in more and more secularized societies, I think religion has left a deep mark on our societies and still shapes lots of things today. And I think by studying historic events like the Protestant Reformation, that was one of the biggest changes in at least European history in the last millennium, we can try to get at the roots of maybe even gaps between different regions today or countries today. So I find these topics just genuinely fascinating.
I would agree with that. So we can learn from things that are happening today from what we see happen in the past. Now, moving to your work that embraces historical data to dive into the link between religion and literacy, why, as an economist, are you interested in understanding this particular link?
Well, I guess we have to recognize that for large parts of history, there weren't any formal schools where kids were sent. If anything, whatever they learned in the family home. There were oral traditions that were passed on from generation to generation. And I guess public schools in larger numbers, to some extent, were religious schools or schools run by the church, at least when we talk about Europe. And here we are back to the Protestant Reformation that I already mentioned, which started in the early 16th century in Germany under Martin Luther, or Martin Luther, as we would say in the English world. And that period of the Protestant Reformation was one of religious debates. So Martin Luther interpreted the Bible differently from the Catholic Church, and he challenged the Catholic Church in many ways. What's the role of the Eucharist, of Holy Communion? So there was lots of religious issues. But he also was passionate about the idea that every Christian should be able to read the Bible by herself or by himself, by themselves. So he wanted every Christian to be able to read. Now, the thing was, back in the day, literacy rates were just between 5 and 10% across Europe. So only a small elite could typically read. So saying that every Christian should be able to read the Bible was like absolutely mad and crazy and unrealistic. But what he really got going was a first kind of public school movement. So in the areas of Europe that became Protestant, he encouraged the political leaders of the day that they would build and maintain schools. And what is even more astonishing, given gender gaps we still observe today in many countries, and just thinking of Afghanistan today, where girls are not allowed to go to school, and Afghanistan has fallen back by decades or centuries in the way it thinks about girls versus boys. What Luther did, he said back in the day, 1520, and would to God that every town had a girls' school also, where the girls could learn the gospel for an hour a day. So he had this idea that not only boys should be taught, but that there should be also dedicated schools for girls. And that is quite amazing. And what we can see in data is that in Protestant areas. Indeed, there was more school building than in Catholic areas, and that gave these Protestant areas a head start in education, and maybe then later on also in generally economic development.
Well, that's really interesting, Sasha, because what I think you're telling us is that religion, through the Bible reading, religion would supply education when that was not mandatory. Like nowadays, everyone is in developed countries has to go to school until a certain age. But not only that, it was also including half of the population, women, who it was even thought more at the time that it was not necessary for them to go to school. So it had these two very impactful effects. And
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
I want to focus today on a particular paper about this topic that you have published relatively recently with a co-author that looks at the impact of the 19th century Protestant expansion in Korea on literacy rates just at the turn of the century. Why is this context interesting and different from the one that you just explained to us?
Yeah, so let me start by saying that, yeah, I spent 5 years in Australia, and there I had a Korean PhD student, Jong-yong Won, who is now back in Korea, where he is an assistant professor. And he and I talked about, interestingly, East and West Germany. And then we talked about North and South Korea, two countries that have seen division as a result of war. Within the same country, two different states, one communist, one capitalist. And with him, I started talking about, well, tell me more about how Korea looked like before it was separated. So, how did the North compare to the South? And then he collected some data. We continued discussing. And at some point, it dawned on us, the two of us, as we discussed, that Korea is quite a fascinating setting when it comes to education and missionaries and all of that, because it's a case where the colonizers were the Japanese, but the missionaries were Westerners. So we have on Korean soil two groups: one, the kind of government that brought their own institutions, and then there were the missionaries as a third force, so to say, alongside the native Koreans. And that is a setting quite different from colonies elsewhere. If you think about Africa, for instance, where, say, the French, the Brits would colonize a country, and the missionaries were typically from those same countries. But here we have the Japanese, and then we have Westerners from the US, from Canada, Australia, Great Britain, who would come to do missionary work. So these missionaries weren't interested in politics very much. So they were only into evangelizing. And so we can study how they might have impacted education for the locals, because that's what they were keen on. And the Japanese government also ran schools, and they weren't interested in religion. So it's a fascinating setting to study.
How the missionaries managed to communicate with Koreans to teach them the Bible or literacy, and what sort of alternative schooling options did Koreans have from the Japanese colonialists in comparison to the Western missionaries' educational options?
So the Japanese ran schools, but back in the day, schooling was not yet compulsory, and there also were school fees, so it wasn't a given that Koreans would attend these schools, A, because of the fees, but also maybe because they did not want to be educated according to a Japanese curriculum. So the Protestant missionaries, how did they communicate? So the issue was they struggled a lot with the Korean language, and they tried hard, but didn't get too far. So the typical way they would communicate with the locals was using translators. And so that naturally restricted the impact they could personally have on a large number of Koreans. So essentially their strategy ended up being building up local Korean pastors that would establish churches and then try to hand over business to these local Koreans ASAP. So again, quite different from what we might have seen in other continents, where missionaries were there and they ran schools and they were highly visible people. Here, the missionaries were mainly interested in getting the local Korean Protestants up and running, but then every further action in terms of educating the population was left to the local Korean religious people. And we think that's a super fascinating setting, also one where we can compare two different groups of Protestants, and I'm happy to talk about that more in detail as we continue. So there were Presbyterians and there were Methodists that were the main two Protestant groups, and they had quite different strategies, and I'm happy to elaborate if you want me to.
So the Western missionaries, what they did is to basically recruit locals so that they became independent and they were the ones who would run the schools and propagate the literacy in Korean. And they were just like an instrument, but they were not directly teaching children, the Westerners,
Exactly.
because of that language barrier. Yeah. I
Yeah,
see.
exactly.
Then tell me, how did you measure the expansion of Protestantism and how it impacted the literacy rates in Korea?
So we bring together various data sources, and I love the fact that your podcast is called Embracing Data, because this is one of these cases where you have to dig through various archives. You rely partly on government statistics, so colonial government statistics, but then also sources of the missionary societies themselves. So in our case, what we do is we trace down directories from the 1930s that lists every single Presbyterian church in Korea, and that is a source from the Presbyterian church itself. And then the Methodist church equally had a directory of all Methodist churches in 1930. So we take stock of the churches, where are they located in Korea in the year 1930. And that is our main treatment variable. So that's the main variable by which we measure exposure to Protestant schooling that could then have an impact on literacy. Literacy, in contrast, we get from government statistics. So the Japanese colonial government wanted to know how many people are there, so a typical population census. But they would also try to figure out whether people can read and write, and they were asking that for both the Japanese language and the Korean language. And obviously, lots of people spoke Korean, but then literacy is about can you read and write in Korean? So that was collected. And then also whether they were fluent in Japanese, and very few people were. So it's really about literacy in Korean. Now, the third source we have is the missionaries. So who were they? Where were they? And when were they where? And that is from a different set of sources that you can find on the web, that where enthusiasts have collected biographic data of every single missionary. So there are websites that would tell us exactly the name of a missionary, where they were born in the US typically, and where they went to university, and then when they were sent as missionaries to Korea, where they landed, where they spent how many years. And all of that allows us also to measure exposure of the local Korean population to these missionaries, that in contrast then may have encouraged Protestant churches to be built and Protestant schools to be built. And all of that then ultimately has an effect on literacy.
So, did you basically look at the correlations between missionary churches or missionaries and literacy rates later on?
Well, to be more precise, what we measure is the number of Methodist and Presbyterian churches, and those are churches run by local Koreans, so by churches that have Korean pastors. And we use the missionaries as an instrumental variable. So that is the trigger that makes these churches happen and built locally by the Koreans. And that in turn has an effect on literacy. There is this two-step process where the presence of missionaries encourages the building and maintenance of Methodist and Presbyterian churches. Those are run by the locals, by the Koreans, and that in turn has an impact on literacy.
Why do you have to use this instrumental variable approach?
People became literate because those missionaries encouraged local people to found churches and run schools that would then teach in the Korean language. So it's important both for the narrative, but also then for the statistical estimates to recognize that there is this causal chain from the missionaries to the local churches and then from there to literacy.
Why didn't you look directly at the impact of the churches on literacy?
We would not then have a story or a rationale why the churches are where they are. They come out of nowhere, so to say. And the historic knowledge we have tells us that we find churches in higher numbers in places where missionaries had interacted with the locals and had converted them to Protestantism, either as Presbyterians or as Methodists. So these things naturally belong together, statistically, but also in terms of what actually happened historically.
You might be worried that the churches are built in places where there might be also naturally higher literacy rates, like in big cities, for example, where there is industry. There might be also more Japanese schools there, and
Yeah, exactly.
you might not be measuring what you want to measure, right?
Exactly. So there could be endogeneity, there could be a purely demand-driven story that where the population was super keen to get literacy, the churches responded by running schools. But in fact, what the history tells us is that the Christian schools were encouraged, so to say, from the outside. So it is as if we dropped aliens from heaven, and it's like missionaries dropping from the US, Australia, Canada on Korean soil. And that's where Christian schools popped up, and those in turn then had an effect on literacy.
That's great. So, this instrumental variable actually helps you to tell a story of how they had an impact and through what the impact was. Is it a bulletproof method? Did it allow you to measure what you think is the true impact of Protestantism on literacy rate? Is it like the holy grail of causality?
Well, I'm always reluctant to give a clear answer to this because no instrumental variable is perfect. But I think it is a setting that is particularly beautiful, exactly because the missionaries come from the outside and they typically have no clue even where they are going. They land on a boat, they follow some road. They go to a place, and only over time the knowledge builds up, even where people are located, because you have to recognize that Korea was called the Hermit Kingdom. So for centuries, Korea was completely closed to the outside world. It was terra incognita. People knew very little about it. So by boat, they would travel there, come to some port that was open to foreigners. They landed, they left the boat, they started marching in some direction. So the places they ended up in was somewhat random. And then from there, they would maybe do trips, day trips, short trips to the countryside. So the locations they ultimately got to had some randomness in it, and hence also the resulting Methodist and Presbyterian churches that were founded by the locals are in places that, due to this outside intervention, are more random than if the Koreans had followed the plan nationally without that foreign intervention.
Sasha, you should be reassured that I'm not the identification police. I just wanted to know a bit more about the story and the channels, and they look pretty convincing to me. Then, overall, can you provide us a figure summarizing more or less the impact of charged schools on literacy? And would you want to elaborate a bit on the difference as well between Methodist and Presbyterian churches?
The way we measure literacy is the number of people who are literate per 1,000 residents. And our headline result is that one more church, be it Methodist or Presbyterian, leads to a 20 people per 1,000 people higher literacy rate. So that's the magnitude we are talking about. So every Methodist or Presbyterian church gets 20 more people per 1,000 educated and literate. Now, the thing about Methodists and Presbyterians is super fascinating, and I think also in the literature, a novel thing, because what we typically see in the existing literature is people look at missionaries and just call them Protestant missionaries or Catholic missionaries. Now, Korea has very few Catholics, but what has not been studied, as far as I can see, is looking at different Protestant denominations. And it's just a matter of fact that Protestantism is not a monolithic thing, but there are different streams within Protestantism that has also different organizational strategy. So here we're also entering the territory of maybe industrial organization and organizational economics. So the Methodists and Presbyterians were organized in a very different way. The Methodists were a relatively hierarchical church, a bit like the Catholics in terms of hierarchy, with a bishop that still then in the missionary times in Korea was headquartered in the US. And then there would be the local churches in Korea, but they would still report to a bishop back in the US. The Presbyterians, in contrast, were more grassroots, and they were more decentralized. And what the Presbyterians did was they followed something that was called the Nevius Plan. Nevius was a church strategy person. And this person's idea was that the so-called three selves, S-E-L-F for self, and new churches should aim for self-governance, for self-support financially, and for self-propagation. So there should be ideally indigenous missionary work. So Koreans talking to Koreans and not Americans talking to Koreans. So this strategy meant that Presbyterians try to train up, skill up Korean pastors, and from then on try to encourage the Koreans to run their own business, to run their own church, to run their own missionary work. Whereas the Methodists still continue to draw a lot of expertise and also money from the US or from outside Korea, and there was continually more reliance on the mother church outside Korea. As a result of that, and that I find still super fascinating and understudied and worth studying also in other countries, the Presbyterians per missionary were much more successful in making disciples, in making people Christians and Christian membership in the Presbyterian church per missionary was far higher. So we have some numbers from 1910. Back in the day, there were 115 Presbyterian missionaries and more than 1,000 Korean priests. And among the Methodists, they had more missionaries, 120, but only 252 Korean priests. So the Presbyterians had a four times as high rate of success in raising up local pastors. And also then they have a larger number of believers, so 140,000 Presbyterians and only 39,000 Methodists. So if we just think about success rates It's like being a salesman traveling, trying to sell stuff door to door back in the day. The Presbyterians were far more successful than the Methodists. So their strategy of making the local self-sufficient and self-propagating really paid off in a higher success rate in winning hearts and minds and souls for Christianity.
And do you think that the fact that the Japanese did not offer free schooling in Korea at the time might also have helped increase the effect of charter schools on literacy rates?
Yeah, that would be a fair point why Christianity or Christian schools were of interest to the locals relative to the government schools, the Japanese colonizer schools. But what we've just been talking about is these within Protestantism differences, and those are not affected by what you're just saying. So that I still find interesting that Presbyterians and Methodists had such different approaches and different success rates with that. But you're absolutely right that one reason why Christianity may have been appealing to people was also that relatively cheaper access to education relative to the Japanese government schools.
This success of the Presbyterians in comparison to the Methodists kind of supports the mechanisms story that it was not the missionaries themselves, but what really worked was to recruit the locals to let them be the ones who would set up the churches and those schools attached to the churches, and that is consistent with the difference also between those who wanted to do it top bottom weren't very successful, while the ones who were going bottom up seemed to be more successful. So going back to the effect, and also going back to something that you mentioned at the beginning, which was the a gender, so an aspect of education that was interesting, that was that women at the time were also then having access to some education that might not have been available otherwise. You mentioned that the impact was around 20 more people becoming literate out of every 1,000. Was this effect different for girls and boys at the time in Korea?
Yeah, so interestingly, the number of additional literate people per thousand was roughly the same for men and women, but also the baseline number of people who is literate differs a lot by gender. So, for instance, the number of males who are literate was in the order of 300 something a man per thousand. But for the females, it was less than 100 who were literate per thousand. So if we see for women an extra, say, 20 or 30 literate people relative to 70, that is a much larger relative effect than an additional 20 or 30 relative to 300. So the effect for women was, in relative terms, stronger than for men. They benefited particularly. And also that has to do with one specific thing that happened in Korea. The Korean pastors were allowed to be married, so they oftentimes had then also wives who were engaged in the church. And also among the missionaries, interestingly, there were lots of women. So we sometimes think of missionaries as, oh, there are all these men who are being sent abroad. No, that's just not the case. There were lots of female missionaries. And in the Korean context, there was this phenomenon of the so-called Bible women. So these were meetings where women would sit together. Maybe in the missionary, female missionary's house where they resided, and they would study the Bible together. And again, studying the Bible together had also a literacy enhancing effect, because it would not just be the missionary reading out the Bible and people memorize stuff, but over time they would also try to teach the locals how to read, interpret the Bible. And then Korean Bible women would take over, and they would then also teach literacy to other women. So even outside the formal school context, with kids sitting in elementary school, there was also, so to say, an adult education stream where women, maybe the mothers of these same kids that attended elementary school, were in a Bible study group with Korean Bible women and thereby became literate at a more advanced age.
So there might be then have been a bit of a role modeling effect, both from the women missionaries, but also the mothers with their children passing on the importance of the being able to read and interpret the Bible, which could have benefited women, particularly because they were in a very in at a disadvantage compared to men in terms of the literacy rate. So in this case, you still see an important impact for women in Korea of Protestantism in respects to the increase of. Now we've coming to an end, but I want to ask you a few things that I ask all the guests about generally your relationship with data and what challenge have you had in this project or generally if you want when doing research and using data.
I love data. Data is always fascinating. And data always tells a story about the context it was collected in. So in this case, I think what I found most fascinating was the biographies of the missionaries. And for me, it was really a discovery process as we went through that to wake up to the fact that a lot of the missionaries were women. So my preconception that was just outright wrong was missionaries are by definition men. And if anything, there may be the wives of the missionaries who come along in some cases, but the people running the show are the men. And that just isn't true. So there were also solo female missionaries, oftentimes students in their early 20s who were passionate about making disciples in remote parts of the world. So that data also allows you to discover things and change your preconceptions. Challenges. We discussed for a long time identification, and you used earlier on the term identification police. In economics, we are always obsessed about getting as close as possible to causality. So also for us, that was a challenge. And we discussed this instrument that we use. But another thing we did is that also, interestingly, in the Korean context, the Presbyterians and the Methodists had at some point made an agreement, so-called committee agreement, where they carved up Korea between themselves. So they would say, this particular province or this particular area is ours, and you don't enter there. So there was areas where only the Methodists went and areas where only the Presbyterians were allowed to go. And this we can also use for identification, because then we have some areas that are assigned to just one of the two groups. And we can compare close to the border, where we have very similar local conditions, but one is exposed to Methodist missionaries, one to Presbyterians. And that's another way we can try to identify effects and differences between the two religious denominations. So, all these things, once you have data, you collect data, you plot data in a map. You see patterns and you wake up to, oh, wow, I could maybe use that for identification. So I think I love that discovery process. But of course, there are always challenges. You wonder, well, can I rely on these statistics? Did anyone have any incentive to lie? How about these Japanese government statistics? What does it mean to be literate? How did they measure that? So all these questions you have to deal with. But overall, I just love data. They tell a story, and you learn so much just by thinking how they were collected, why and how. And yeah, I love these kinds of projects.
It's really great that you're sharing your passion with data. It doesn't seem like any challenge is hard enough for you to have the excitement to go and jump in just to answer your question of interest. But moving away from research, based on your life experience, how has data been useful in your everyday life, if it has?
I like measuring stuff, also like sports. I go running. I like to keep track of my fitness. And of course, I use data to decide on which restaurant to go to, where to travel, and all of that. At the same time, I'm also an experimental guy. So, independent of the ratings and rankings, I just like to explore stuff, maybe just based on recommendations of people I trust. So I don't always just go by the numbers, but I think data is useful, tells a lot. And I can only encourage your listeners, I guess many students among them, to embrace data. I really love that term, embrace data, learn to love data. There is so much in it.
What I can read from the way you use data in your everyday life is that averages and descriptive statistics are good, but everyone is different, and
Yes.
we are not all in the middle.
Absolutely, yeah.
So thank you very much, Sasha, especially for taking today us along this historical journey and for sharing how you've embraced data. And I'm loving that you love this term. To answer your question and also taking it along in your everyday life. It has given us a lot to think about. Thanks everyone as well for listening, and see you in the next episode of Embracing Data.